For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
And it is 5:05, and you're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. But my partner, Tim Jones, is out today, and in with me today is Todd Showalter, a political satirist and syndicated political cartoonist. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here. The ankle bracelet hurts a little bit, but I'm doing okay.
I think they can loosen that up if you
tried, and the thing is, it starts beeping, and I cut my finger on it, so it's actually more difficult than you think.
That's what I've been hearing. Yeah. I hear it beep. Every now and then. You know, I want to get to our next guest, give her plenty of time. She is Rachel Ferguson. She's an economics professor at Concordia University, and she's director of the Free Enterprise Center at the university. Rachel, how are you?
I'm good. I just to tell everyone, I'm a philosophy professor, but I do
philosophy
economics.
I'm sorry.
It's very confusing.
That's okay.
Or isn't it confusing?
Exactly. Hey, I wanted to get you on because I wrote an editorial op-ed for Martin Luther King Day, and Project 21 syndicated it to a bunch of newspapers, and my lovely wife was Google searching my name and found one of those newspapers had a counterpoint to my article, and I was like, Rachel Ferguson, I know that face. So I didn't read your counterpoint because I want to hear it fresh with the audience. So give us your counterpoint to my argument that the reason that the Republican Party, African Americans were coming to the Republican Party was because of crime and what was my other? I can't even think of my other thing. I'm having a whatchamacallit moment. But
socialism.
Education.
Crime and education.
Yeah.
But give us your counterpoint.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of funny that they had a point counterpoint because I definitely included crime and education in my reasons as well.
They just wanted conflict, Rachel. I think that's what it was.
Yeah. Well, and I was looking at racial shifts in general, so Latino and Black Americans. That's what I was asked to write on for the op-ed. And so, you know, you start out with immigration, where I think I just wanted to debunk some of the myths. And one of the myths is the assumption that Latino voters are all, you know, sort of open borders types or something like that. Yeah. And that's not true because, of course, many Latino voters are themselves or the children of legal immigrants, and they can become they can have a certain level of consternation with people who came in illegally, and so that surprises people, I think, sometimes, that there's more of a sense that people should have to go through the same process that they went through.
So
anyway, that was just a little bit of a debunk. Now, I did say that I think some, you know, the idea of attention to the working class and the sense that maybe we're competing for jobs with immigrants plays a role, which I think is actually too bad because I don't think most of us are competing with jobs for immigrants. I actually think that's a myth, but it is something that is compelling to a lot of people and can move their vote a bit.
How far do you see this going in the long term? Do you think this is a short-term phenomenon, or is this something that the liberal progressive Democratic Party should be fearful of losing not only African-American vote, but Hispanic and could be Asian vote as well?
Yeah, actually, Asian numbers are shifting as well. I think this is a long-term change. I think ultimately I agreed with you, a point that you made in your op-ed, which is that the move of the Democrats to the very far left, or the willingness to like keep on giving in to the left wing fringe on things that are really far out there, like adolescent transitioning, you know, gender transitioning or polyamory or whatever, very far out stuff. We're talking about Blacks and Latinos who are either Catholic or oftentimes members of the Black church, Black evangelicals, and quite socially conservative. And so it's interesting. Noah Smith has some evidence showing that the further left you go in the Democratic Party, the richer and whiter you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though we associate people of color with the Democratic Party, they've always been the most centrist members of the party. And that's true economically, too. They're very entrepreneurial. So they tend to be not socialist. You know, maybe there's a little more or a little less fiscal conservatism, but they're not socialist at all. And so the idea of sort of the squad and that crowd, that's very fringe for most Black and Latino mm-hmm. families. And so I think the further left the Democrats go, the more people, almost out of desperation, will begin to jump ship because it's really not fitting in with their worldview anymore. And the problem has been that Republicans, I think around the 1980s, sort of decided they didn't need to court these people too much, and so they didn't, and it wasn't a very welcoming place for minorities. And I think that that's, I hope that that's changing. I think that that's changing, but I do kind of say at the end of my article, it's really important for Republicans to side more with people like Tim Scott and his attitude, which is one of being able to really be very honest about our history, our difficult history, while at the same time holding conservative views, as opposed to, you know, maybe more provocateurs like Candace Owens, mm-hmm. who doesn't, I don't think, have the same amount of traction with minority viewers as she does with a lot of, let's say, old white conservative guys.
Yeah. And that's been my criticism of her.
Well, it's been said before also that there's been a shift that the Republican Party has a lot of similarities to the Democratic Party of the past. I mean, we've said it before that I think John F. Kennedy probably, you know, would have been a Republican nowadays. I mean, don't you see that shift?
Yes, no, that's absolutely true. And we're actually seeing a measurable shift in the way that the Democrats are really associated now with these, with high incomes, high levels of education, very much sort of the elite, while Republicans, who we used to think of as the big business guys, are now really associated more with the working class. It's been a really interesting flip that's happened there. And so that's going to be more compelling to people in the working class, whatever color they are.
And you also brought up a good point.
Like they're being seen.
You brought up a good point about the entrepreneurials. Because I've seen and I've heard, rather, there's some people that have come over that have had a hard time getting jobs, and just out of necessity, they have started businesses. And so you do have that ingenuity that you may not have with, some from the other party, or some from the other side, rather. Do you see that? And do you see that as possibly one of the reasons that they are, you know, coming over to the Republican side?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the more elite you go, the more establishment. It's weird in a way because there's the cultural views are so odd that the far left holds. They seem almost crazy. Mm-hmm. But they're going to be more and more associated with the establishment, with who is already established. And as a classical liberal libertarian leaning person myself, we who love the market and love the free market have actually always been very critical of businesses that come established and then use their position to become cronyistic, mm-hmm. right? And to buy off the politicians and shut out competitors and make it hard for small business and make it hard for startups. That's exactly what a lot of established businesses do. So, there is that sense of tension there. And for those people who want to be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, which I think a lot of Black and Latino families want to do, the Democratic Party is becoming increasingly unattractive. It's the party of big regulation.
Speaking with Rachel Ferguson, philosophy professor at Concordia University and the director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia University. I want to ask you one more thing before we go on to your talk about your book, co-author of the book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace. It seems like the real diehard constituency within the Democratic Party right now is Black females. Black males have shifted 20% in the last election to the Republican Party. Want to get your thoughts, because you study this. Why do you think there is such an allegiance of Black females to the Democratic Party right now?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that's actually true in general, right? That females go a little to the left or a little more liberal in terms of polling than males. And I don't know that I know the answer to that question, mm-hmm. but I will say that I think, you know, I'm a woman myself, so I don't mean to criticize my own sex, but I do think that we are in a more vulnerable position in some ways in society, and so in terms of having to often be the caretakers, for instance, for people who are dependent on us. And so I think for anyone who's coming from the perspective of not necessarily feeling enough support from the community or from the family structure that they're in, they will turn to government. I'm not saying that that's the right thing to do. I'm just saying that that may be an impulse, right? That we need to make sure the government has all of these special social safety nets. The trouble with that, of course, is that it can often undermine the development of that civil society and family structure support that is actually what we really need. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of Black men and men in general are feeling aimless in the sense of being shut out of their role as the ones who, you know, are going to be providing. And so there's more of a backlash now of trying to reclaim that. I think you're seeing that with some of the masculinity stuff that's going on. Some of it is toxic. It goes way too far. But that's just kind of, it's a backlash.
And you would think that Black women would see that because Black men are trying to reclaim their role is from the government in the 1960s taking the Black male out of the household.
Exactly.
And you seem like you would see that connect the dots there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think some Black women do. But I also, it's been really interesting in writing my book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace. I came across the work of Black sociologist Orlando Patterson. And he points out that there's actually a higher level of distrust between Black men and Black women than there are in other elements of our society.
Oh, yeah.
There's all kinds of history to that, right? It has to do with the fact that Black men were relegated to manual labor and Black women were brought into being secretaries and teachers because white people were more comfortable with them in the house, right? And in their presence. And so there's lots of history to that story. But what that means is that there's a lot of distrust there that needs to be repaired. And I think that that makes it harder for Black women to make space for what Black men are trying to accomplish.
And that's a discussion that Black men and Black women as a African-American can tell you need a discussion that needs to be had, to tell you that.
I mean, I may be wrong in this, so correct me. Was it before the Johnson era? Wasn't the nuclear Black family, wasn't that more predominant than white families at one point?
Yes. So the actual marriage rates were higher among Black Americans up to the 50s.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's true. And so that's why the story Patterson is telling actually does make sense, because the idea is that as you see more Black participation in the economy, the comfort level of white people causes them to sort of advance Black women faster than Black men. You also have a lot of racism in the unions, which keeps men out of those union jobs. Really bad, up until the 60s even. And so what that means is that parents even start responding. They start educating women for college, for the professions, and men for manual labor. And that can be really undermining, I think, to the Black masculine ethos.
Kind of comes down to control, and that comes down to, you know, if you have control, you have votes. You break up the nuclear family and you make people dependent on the government, you're going to have their votes. And I think it's a travesty what happened. And I have, I'm surprised that they've gotten the Democrats have gotten the vote, gotten their votes for so long. I mean, hopefully everybody's waking up, as you said, and, they're awake and they can come to their senses.
I agree, but I really want to bring the confrontation to the Republicans here, because I do think that Republicans have gotten a reputation for, I get that we want to tell the truth and we want to be honest about things, but I think they've gotten the reputation for kind of flagellating the Black community,
what do you mean?
For all of its failures. The idea of someone like, Candace Owens being as popular as she is, she's very, very negative about the Black community. Well, there are a lot of negative things, but what about the positives, right? What about the Black church? What about Frederick Douglass? What about Booker T. Washington? What about Zora Neale Hurston, right? There's all these wonderful things that we could be drawing upon in terms of a kind of Black conservative legacy. But instead of doing that, I often hear Republicans focusing only on the negative and only on the breakdown. And I actually appreciated in Chris's piece how he was pointing out that we do have celebratory stories, right? We have these amazing, business accomplishments in the Black community and economic growth. and the people we're really concerned about are a minority of people who are stuck in poverty. It's not the general black community that's stuck in poverty. It's a particular group. And so I think Republicans could be more nuanced. They could be more forthcoming about black history and the difficulties that black people have experienced in America. And I think they would have a much more compelling case to make if they were.
Yeah, Rachel, I want to talk about in our closing minutes, you're the co-author of the book Black Liberation Through the Marketplace. And as someone who was a child of entrepreneurs and my parents were successful business owners, I've always thought entrepreneurship is the quickest way for upward mobility for not only African Americans, but for any marketplace, for any race, excuse me. But give us the thesis of Black Liberation Through the Marketplace.
Yeah, so in that book, I really try to show that conservatives and libertarian types, classical liberals, can do a really good job of talking about Black American history, honestly, by pointing out how so much of the exclusion has been economic in nature. The historical exclusion of Black people often involved violations of their property rights, their contract rights, their equal protection of the rule of law, things that we as conservatives or libertarians really, really value. You have a strong pro-constitutional Black tradition. And so you have Black people appealing to American principles in order to say, hey, we just want to be a part of. And that's different, of course, from the left, which is saying that our history of racism is so bad that it undermines the American project, right? It really means that there's no hope. So this is a hopeful, it's honest, but it's hopeful. And I think we can do that. We should be able to do a better job of that as conservatives. And then when we look at solutions, we want to look at things that are really about getting the government out of people's way and building people up through civil society, not always through an appeal to government programs, which have tended to be the problem more than the solution.
Well, Rachel, I just want to say I'm glad that we agreed more than we disagreed.
We definitely agreed a lot.
Because she's the most level-headed liberal I've ever spoken to.
I was very nervous all afternoon because I was like, oh my God, she's brilliant and she's going to wipe the floor with me. But I appreciate you coming on. And you are Rachel Ferguson. You are a philosophy professor at Concordia University, and you're also director of the Free Enterprise Center there. Give folks your socials where they want to buy your book or read more of your stuff.
Yeah, my book is on sale at Amazon now. It's only $15, so run out and grab it. It's actually very readable. You can find me at Liberty Ethics on Twitter, at Liberty Ethics, and of course, Facebook and LinkedIn as well. Rachel Ferguson at Concordia Chicago.
Rachel, thank you so much, and wake your hubby up and tell him what a great job you did.
Okay, I will. Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Wow.
I think Rachel would take issue with, she's not a liberal. She is a libertarian.
Okay, yes. Liberal. Oh, I thought you said she was more on the liberal side. My mistake.
That's what I said. She might take a little offense for that, but never mind.
Well, as she should.
When we come back, we're going to take a quick call from Kerry. He wants to talk about, he was in the military, and talk about Ukraine. And then we'll have Andrew Krabischitz. We'll get to him. He's the chief executive of Red Balloon, and we've talked to him many times here, and he'll give an analysis on the labor market since last week's CPI. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Sarb Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
And welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Sarb Show. Probably the best born section in rock and roll Chicago, most definitely. Before we get to our next guest, Andrew Krabischitz, Chief Executive Officer of Red Balloon, Kerry's been waiting a while on the line. Kerry, how are you, sir?
Kerry? Kerry may have left the building.
Sorry
about that, Kerry. We had him waiting a little while there, but Andrew Krabischitz is on the line. Andrew, how are you, sir?
Well, I am doing great. Nice to talk to y'all.
You know, I think the last time that we had you on, sir, that you guys were facing a blizzard, practically. Was that correct? Have you dug out from that?
You know, so here's the thing. Is a lot of people are worried about global warming. I am not. I think global warming will make Idaho the new California. And I think I'm just anticipating that in the future. So, no, we dug out of the blizzard. We question our life choices about living in a frozen tundra. But actually right now it's in the 40s. It's delightful. People are out in shorts. You know, it's summer weather again.
See, Yellowstone makes people want to live up there now and dress all Western. You dress Western? You got cowboy boots, all that?
You know, the funny thing is I am wearing cowboy boots today.
There you go.
With shorts on?
Not with shorts. Not with shorts. Okay. But I grew up in California, but I married a Texas gal, and so she's like, you need to wear cowboy boots. So, yes. No, we live the full outdoor extravaganza up here in Idaho.
All right.
You'll be welcome anytime.
All right, let's get to business here. I want to get your thoughts on something that I heard on the news today where it said that 1 in 4 workers are still working from home and that Fortune 500 companies and other companies are now wanting workers to come back to work, but they are facing resistance. Your thoughts on that? Are you seeing any increase in your business because of that?
Yeah, no, it's actually a really interesting trend we're seeing right now where managers, businesses, and you see the headlines from, you know, the Elon Musk of the world who are like, you know, get in the office or don't bother and come back at all. But a lot of other businesses that vowed that they would be hybrid or remote, a lot of them don't even have office space anymore because they let their leases go away because, like, why would I have this cost? Because we're never going to work together in the office. And for a lot of workers, the average worker in America right now is actually a lot of them are looking to work from home. They think this is a huge advantage. And I would say, well, what the data that we're showing from Red Balloon and all the interviews we're doing with employers is that there is a short-term productivity bump that comes from working at home because you don't have all the distractions of the you know, the lunchroom and the water cooler and all those things. So you actually get more done for a short amount of time, but then you lose some of the creativity and productivity that happens with collaborating with other people. But even here on redballoon.work, where we have a lot of conservative and even mainstream, you know, job seekers who are just looking for freedom at work, a lot of them are saying, look, I want to work from home, and businesses are pushing back. I personally think if you're a business today, you should look for quality of candidate and culture fit first. But if you can, being in the office is a way more productive way to get things done, no matter what the worker says they want to do. So this is definitely kind of this tension point that we're seeing between employers and employees today. Where's the most productive place for them to be working?
Yeah, I agree with that productivity standpoint, too, because I'm a cartoonist. I've worked by myself alone for over 30 years. So when I get out in a situation like I'm in today, I mean, it's really pretty exciting to actually see faces and, you know, get to talk to people. And I agree with you that I think that collaboration, the creative, you know, vibe that happens just through interacting with other people, I don't care, you know, especially if you're a writer, you do what I'm doing. I mean, you can try to, you know, kind of imagine that and come up with it yourself. But until you get around other people, you really don't get that feedback and that kind of that creative juice going that you do when you're just sitting by yourself. Do you think, where I'm going with this, do you think that there's a compromise down the road where people, there is some type of thing where, you know, people can have that space to work by themselves, but there's like a collaborative place or location where, you know, they could, you know, get together and, you know, get the creative juices going?
Yeah, I think employers are going to have to be flexible on some of these things, but we all know the creativity doesn't happen over Zoom or Teams or Google Meet or any of the things. It's simply not the same because if you're on those meetings, if you're meeting with that person, you have an agenda, and when you're done with the agenda, you kind of leave. Whereas when you're in an office, when you're interacting with people, when you're even at a coffee shop, you're going to come up with ideas that aren't on that agenda that are really going to be some of the world-changing ideas we've seen. And in fact, if you look at there's some data on worker productivity in America showing basically not how many people are working, but how productive they are with the hours that they're putting in America. And it has been on a decline for 2 years. So I think that there will be some increased amount of pushback from employers who are looking for higher productivity numbers out of people that that they're going to see in a workplace. But employers are going to continue to have to be flexible. At redballoon.org, 80% of our jobs are for in-location, but 80% of our applications are for remote work. People love the remote work concept. And part of that is a lot of conservatives are saying, hey, how do I have my California job and live in beautiful places like Missouri or Iowa where my freedoms won't be curb stomped constantly? So I think some of this is going to come out in the wash as more employers realize that there's great workers out there that can be free. And some of it's just going to be we're going to have a new normal where people are going to want to have this hybrid work environment, meeting only at coffee shops or on occasions.
Speaking with Andrew Krapischetz, Chief Executive Officer of RedBalloon.org. Andrew, can companies make an argument for keeping workers remote that, say, a worker was working in California and coming to the office and was making a California salary, but they moved to Missouri or Idaho or somewhere else where the cost of living is cheaper, they can still get that high quality of work but not have to pay them those salaries, those higher salaries? Is that an incentive for companies, or is it more productive to have these folks eventually come in, do you think?
Yeah, what I think is going to happen, because that is happening quite a bit, and a lot of those companies are saying, look, you moved to Idaho, you've been there for a year, and you really just need to have a cost of living adjustment. You're not allowed to have that Bay Area salary anymore. What I think is going to happen, and I've actually started to talk to some of our RedBalloon.org employers, and what they're starting to do is they're starting to establish satellite offices in some of these rural and remote areas where if you can have an office even of 5 or 6 or 7 people in a Moscow, Idaho, in a small town, you're going to get that collaboration. You're going to get that creativity that comes out of the in-person without having to have everybody be in San Francisco and pay San Francisco rent, San Francisco salaries, et cetera. So that's what we're starting to see, where people, instead of doing a full remote, they're starting to say, how do we establish a small satellite office and maybe multiple small satellite offices around the country in these smaller areas where they still have access to amazing talent, but aren't kind of stuck with some of the prices that are associated with these big areas.
I think you're also getting rid of, you know, I think the whole 9 to 5 thing or 8 to 5 or whatever. I mean, that's almost, I mean, that seems like such a corporate mentality. I think that's a big turnoff for a lot of people that, you know, here I go, it's 8 o'clock. I can't leave until it's 5 o'clock. You're in a cubicle, you know, you're just waiting for the hours to go by. I think if you got rid of a lot of that, and even if you were in an office setting, you know, as long as you got your work done and you worked in a collaborative environment, you know, your hours were up to you.
Absolutely. No, I've personally hired thousands of people over the years. And the reality is that workers who have autonomy and mastery, where they're treated like adults, and told, you know, even at redballoon.org, we don't actually have a vacation policy. We say, look, take as much vacation as you want and get your job done. And if you don't get your job done, I'll probably have to let you go. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to babysit you on how many hours you take in vacation. And when employers treat their employees like adults, and even through COVID, like, hey, if you want to wear a mask, knock yourself out. And if you don't, it's a free country, do what you want. When you treat people like that, they're way more productive. They don't mind being in the office because they're actually, again, treated like adults and not being nannied in every aspect of their life. So I totally agree. If you can have a flexible work environment where you're not punching people in on the time clock and out on the time clock, but you're saying, look, you're a productive person, you're an adult, your job is to get your work done, and I'm not going to try and babysit you in every aspect. Those are going to be way more productive people in your organization.
Andrew, we keep hearing predictions from Wall Street and other economists predicting a recession, but every month we're seeing 200,000 plus jobs being created, which is was a pretty good clip. As someone who is in the hiring business and sees a lot of this, what's your prediction for 2023? Are we headed for a recession, do you think?
You know, I think we're going to have a mixed bag, if I were to guess. And the reason I say that is because you have one of the bellwethers of an economy is durable good production and orders, because durable goods take a lot longer to produce. Therefore, you can kind of look into the future on how much people are buying things and the velocity of money. Durable goods orders are up like 20% over the last year. So I actually don't see a significant recession coming, but I do think we're going to get a mixed bag. I mean, we've talked about go woke, go broke. I think you're going to see some of these big tech companies, and of course we see them in the news when Amazon lays off 17,000 people. But then again, I talked to a small IT company that's actually on Red Balloon, and they said, well, we have 85 employees today, and we think by the end of 2023, we're going to have 250 employees because of the amount of work that we have to do right now. So I think we're going to continue to see a mixed bag. Red states are going to continue to do well because the policies are going to drive economic activity, economic freedom. And I think blue states are going to continue to struggle. When you tax people to death, it really does have an impact on how they're hiring, how they're thriving as a business. Again, net, I think we're going to have not a full recession, but we are going to have a mixed bag where some areas are going to feel it, and some areas are actually going to thrive through the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, you had an article recently in Daily Caller, woke is bad for work. And you said that's why many are quitting. What is the synopsis of your article?
Yeah, so there's a couple interesting data points here that you need to be looking at. So Monster.com, which is just a job board out there, not nearly as good as Red Balloon.
Of course, but
they did do a really interesting survey and asked workers, and it was a pretty high representation survey. They asked workers, how many of you are going to be looking for a new job in 2023? And the answer was 96% of the people they talked to said they're going to be looking for a job in 2023. Well, that when you see a number like that, you either need to not believe it or you need to say, okay, what in the world is going on here? Because of the 160 million plus workers in America, if the vast majority of them are looking to move, that's an enormous amount of economic upheaval. So we decided we need to dig into that data a little bit more. And it turns out that about a third of the people in that survey who said, I'm going to be looking for a new job this year, they said, we're going to be looking for a new job because we have a toxic work environment where I'm not allowed to be free, right? And of course, it's Monster.com, so they're not going to say, well, it's woke work environment or anything like that. But I think that there's a lot of people right now who are looking for freedom in the workplace, and that's kind of a growing movement. Obviously, that's what I'm trying to help with. But what's going to happen is if you have these companies, if the wealth of a nation is their talent, if their people are the most important asset of any corporation, if you have that many people who are just getting fed up with these toxic work environments where, you know, you have to constantly watch your back so you don't get knifed in the back, and you have to walk on eggshells around certain groups who demand a certain pronoun to be said around them. When you're in that type of work environment, it is toxic. And if all of the good workers leave, if all these good, hardworking conservatives leave these large businesses, it will have a disproportionate impact on those organizations. And so we're already seeing this with some organizations, but I think it's only going to start to snowball in 2023 as workers realize there's still a tight labor market and they don't have to stay in a toxic work environment. There are other options out there. So that's kind of the thesis of what I was trying to push on.
I think it's so ironic, too. The irony of all these things that they put in place, whether you want to call them woke or whatnot, they say they're doing it to prevent a toxic work environment. When these policies are, in fact, are so ridiculously toxic that if you misrepresent somebody by what pronoun they are or something, then all of a sudden, you're in trouble. You're stricken down. To me, that is toxic. When the other side will say, well, no, you have to do it because we're trying to prevent people from being toxic. I've known people firsthand that just have to, they've quit their jobs, well-paying jobs, just because it became so ludicrous.
Right. It absolutely is ludicrous. I had a gentleman tell me the other day, and he works at a Fortune 500 company, and both the company and he will remain nameless to protect the innocent. Mm-hmm. Well, not the company, but him. But he said he was told, if you want a promotion or a raise at this organization, you need to become a woman.
What?
Because those are the only people we are going to give raises or promotions to at this company for this year. If you want that, And like when you're in that environment, when you know there's nothing I can do, no matter how hard I work, no matter how smart I am, I simply cannot get ahead in this organization. I would look to leave. And he's looking to leave right now.
See, so, I misunderstood you. I thought as a male, if somebody, they were going to come to me and say, oh, Todd, you have to be a woman now. I mean, that to me was a little extreme, but I see what you're saying now.
Andrew, give everyone the socials where people can get more information about Red Balloons or some of your columns.
Yeah, so redballoon.work. We've got a blog there. You can follow us. You can download the Employee Bill of Rights and Responsibilities. You can go to any of the woke and non-woke social media platforms, and we're at Red Balloon Work, and we would love to have you connect. We'd love to help you find freedom in the workplace, and if you're an employer, we'd love to help you find your next great hire.
Andrew, continued success to you, my friend, and Happy New Year, and we will talk again to you soon.
Nice to talk to you guys. Have a great day.
Excellent. You know, when we come back, I want to close out the show talking about this Prince Harry.
Oh, that's always a good one.
Best-selling book ever, the Frostbitten Tallywhacker. Kate, you know what I'm talking about?
I do know you're talking about.
Well, Chris, I was going to mention before we got he mentioned social media. Mm. I want you to know that one of my cartoons, it's actually been on the station site. I've been kicked off Facebook again.
Oh, my.
Because they went back, they dug this up. Mm-hmm. It was about the COVID vaccine thing, and now I'm kicked off Facebook again.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, you guys have actually. Seriously, I think this is like 24 times I've been kicked off Facebook. But yeah, it was. But I'm like a veteran, and so I have my own cell. Mm. But so I'm kicked off Facebook for a while
we'll
now.
Talk about it when we come back on the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show on 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
The problem with this bill is not that it makes anything, that it is not that it provides any new protections for infants. The problem with this bill is that it endangers some infants by stating that that infant must immediately be brought to the hospital, where, depending on the circumstances, that may be the right thing to do for the health and survival of that infant, or it may not. That is the problem with this bill. It directs and mandates a certain medical care which may not be appropriate, which may be endanger the life of an infant in certain circumstances. That's why we oppose this bill.
How is trying to save a baby's life going to endanger the baby's life?
There's no
logic. Am
I
missing there? Welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. One more segment left before we get to the Larry Connors USA Rap show. Katie, help me there. What are we...
It's Larry Connors USA.
That's USA.
It.
All right.
Larry Connors USA.
You know, leave it to me to screw it up.
You know, Chris.
It took me a year to finally get your last name correct. So.
Oh, God. Don't remind him what my old last name was.
Yes, please, because I'll get stuck on it. Hey, but as I said before we go to break, and then Todd, we'll get to what you were talking about.
Oh, that's okay.
It's important. But
it is.
But Katie follows popular culture and this type of thing a little more than I do, and I just want to get your reaction. Are you shocked that that Prince Harry's book is now the best-selling nonfiction book of all time? We know that the royal family, people watch them, paparazzi follow them, but did you think there was this type of buzz, and why?
No. I definitely didn't think. And, you know, forgive me, I'm going to be very skeptical about that as well. I'm like,
you don't
who
think
put together
copies?
Who put together the numbers? Who ran the data? Mm. Was it People magazine? Because if it was, I'm skeptical.
Right. As far as like it being the number one, it's the number one book?
Nonfiction book selling of all time.
Yeah, no way. Yeah. Seriously? Harry thing?
Harry and Meghan, Mary.
Who cares?
But, you know, there's a lot of people that I think, and now on the devil's advocate side, this I can believe to be true. I think there has never ever been a complete tell-all book about the underlying issues happening with the royal family. Because
like a frostbitten penis?
Exactly.
Frostbitten penis.
Oh, yeah, that's part of it.
Is that a country song?
No, it's
who's
not.
Who's saying that? Tim McGraw? But I think
part of the book.
Part of what's intriguing about this is that they're, you know, the royal family has been so hush-hush and have kept their secrets very well, and nobody's really reported on what's been going on in the royal family for years and years and years. So that scandal, that intrigue to be like, what is actually happening behind closed doors? I think it probably did sell well. But to say it's number one.
Is so, okay.
I'm calling BS.
So tell me this. I mean, are the brothers' relationship irreparably damaged now? Is it over? Is the royal family irreparable damage? And I'm just asking. I don't care, Todd. You know, and I know a lot of us don't care. I'm just curious. Where does it go from
here?
It's
the end of the world.
I think it is. I think that, you know, when you are willing and able to expose your family's disagreements or their dirt or the skeletons in the closet, I don't know how you really come back from something like that. I mean, maybe Willie and Kate will say, let's give it another go. But right. I can say from personal experience, if I were to do that to my family, they would be like, what the hell is wrong with you and why are you doing
it?
You know
what's going to happen, though, here? I guarantee it. Mm-hmm. This is going to be more important than the Kardashians pretty soon. And I don't know anything bigger than the Kardashians, except maybe my sock drawer.
And the book has been out, the book has been out a week or so now. I mean,
I'm sorry I missed it.
Are we learning any really?
I don't think so.
Secrets besides Harry's frostbite problem and when he was in the Afghan War.
I think it's all basically the same stuff that we knew was coming. I think a lot of it is surrounded by Harry's life growing up, but also whenever he got into a relationship with Meghan, how they treated Meghan, how they treated their son. I don't know if there's anything that's super groundbreaking, but I haven't read it.
Super groundbreaking with the royal family. Yeah, I don't know. There's just like there's some things that I really, I mean, some things I really take an interest in, and there's some things I don't. Yeah. And I think you just hit on one that I really don't have.
I hear you.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain, you know, again, yeah. I'm going to go back to rearranging my sock drawer.
I don't care about the royal family that I don't follow it. I think the only thing that makes it relevant is Harry's book is the number one best-selling nonfiction book of all time. So that I think that fact alone makes it newsworthy. Now, beyond that...
Do people still read, though? I mean, I don't even know. Yeah. Okay, that's just...
Download it on the Kindle.
Well, the Kindle. Does it have pictures in it? Not the frostbitten penis.
And the audio book is where I heard the clip where he talks about that. He was in Afghanistan.
Does he talk like this? Oh, my penis has been frostbitten. And, I don't know what I'm going to do now.
I don't think we should say the word anymore. I think we've used up the word.
Apparently Elizabeth Arden is good to
Elizabeth
to put that on there. So it was
okay. Now we're really we're going down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what's number.
This is what's number one. Number one.
The number one book. And okay,
I just don't see why that would be some. And I don't think anybody in this room is like super intrigued by the idea of the royals. But there are a lot of people that love that reality TV kind of aspect, like you said, with the Kardashians.
And they have an IQ of 2. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, okay, I shouldn't generalize. Maybe some, but no, I mean, why? Who cares? Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, I just do not try. You have these people when it's like the Kardashians, okay? Their whole job is to be famous, okay? Well, they haven't done anything, but their job is to be famous, all right? For what? I mean, who cares? I don't care. Go out and do something. Yeah. You know, run a 30-second mile or I don't know, a cure cancer or something. But these people, I don't care. Yeah. Who cares?
I don't think anyone in our audience probably cares. I think it's newsworthy just for the fact that he has sold with this cold so-called tell-all.
And what's the deal with her? What's the deal with her? Okay, everybody hates her, don't they? I mean, see now I'm getting some snippets here of this gossip. But see, even though
it's intriguing, now you're like,
now,
what about her?
Don't pull me in.
I think they just both. I believe it's relevant is just because of the aspect of them saying they'd want nothing to do with the family and they escaped it like they escaped Guantanamo Bay.
Right.
But really.
Yeah.
Now they're just selling the hype.
And Katie, right. Who's the columnist that is about to be canceled because he wrote this scathing article saying he hopes she dies and she...
Oh my God, I don't know.
And he is a British columnist and he wrote that he hopes that she has to go through the Cersei scene from Game of Thrones.
It's not Piers Morgan, I hope.
No.
Piers.
You know how they're saying shame in Thrones? That this guy wrote that she should go through something like that.
I think a lot of people in the UK and in England, like, I think that they feel that way. Yeah. I think that they think that Harry and Meghan are the ultimate betrayal.
Yeah, I know I would. I do. I do.
Is that how you feel about Biden?
Well, you know, if Biden were to write a tell-all book, I don't know. It would be what? Something about Pop-Tarts and marshmallows? I don't know what it would be about.
Tall tales.
It would be told by someone. When I was quarterback at Navy and then driving a truck and then, these wild yarns here. No, it's nutty. It's nutty. But, you know, I'm going to go out and buy it, though. No, I'm not. No. I wouldn't even give him my money for that. That's insane. But it's seriously, that's what it's all about. It's like, I'm just going to be famous for being famous.
Yeah, well, they're making, I can't imagine the money. I mean, I'm sure they're making like a quarter a book, but, you know, 2 million people by a quarter.
I can't wait for the movie.
My God. I hope
the miniseries.
I hope there's no movie.
Yeah.
Todd, great. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, thank you for letting
today.
Me out of
my tomorrow will be Susie Moore, Managing Deputy Editor of RedState.com. You've been listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1. News Talk STL. Larry Connors is next.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.